Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Welcome to Coronomics, The Spectator's six-part series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. This podcast features our panel, based around the world, who select a story each week that gives you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. Silvia Ciarilli Borelli is reporting from Rome, and Milan correspondent for the Financial Times. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong, and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Nick Gillespie is reporting from New York City, an editor-at-large for Reason magazine. Welcome all. So, Jennifer, I'm going to start with you because you've brought the good news this week, and then I fear that the stories brought by our panelists start going downhill from there. Tell us what's happening in Hong Kong, the stories in the Asia Times.
That's right. So on Friday, Hong Kong relaxed its social distancing measures and allowed certain businesses to reopen with restrictions. So those included bars, gyms, beauty parlors that are basically allowed to operate on the condition that they maintain certain hygiene standards. So that's essentially testing the temperature of customers when they come in, ensuring that there's alcohol gel available at counters, and also that they adhere to a cap on the maximum number of customers that they accept in one go to 8. And so that cap was initially, it was lifted from 4. So that's in accordance with newly relaxed public gathering restrictions. So this was primarily triggered by more than 20 consecutive days without a local infection. So all of the recent new coronavirus cases have all been imported. We spoke about this in our previous episodes, but those travelers have been tested upon arrival and then subsequently sent to quarantine or medical facilities. So at the moment, our current tally stands at 1,444 infections with 4 deaths. So that's relatively low. And there has been talk of the prospect of Hong Kong being declared free of local transmissions if there are no such cases in 28 days from the latest new infection. So 28 days is the equivalent of 2 incubation cycles. So we are seeing the territory return to normal, but it's worth mentioning that this isn't a total lift of restrictions. There are certain businesses that have to remain closed, so namely karaoke establishments, party rooms, and nightclubs. And it's interesting that the article picked up on this because there is some context behind the decision to keep those businesses closed. So at the peak of the outbreak several months ago, there were clusters of infections at karaoke facilities. And so dozens of partygoers would be infected in one go because, of course, the way that karaoke facilities operate is that, you know, you rent a room for several hours and then you eat and drink and have a good time. So subsequently in March, the government attempted to ban the sale of alcohol at places like bars and pubs because, according to the chief executive, people may, quote, become intimate when drunk. So make of that what you will. But ultimately, the government pulled out of attempting to implement this ban because, of course, there was widespread backlash. So that's part of the reason why those establishments have remained closed. And since the implementation of these restrictions several months ago, authorities have faced pressure from businesses. So even at one point, some fitness centres called on the government to repay them up to $2 million Hong Kong dollars in compensation for the loss of businesses during the weeks of closure. So the government has been facing external pressure, but you know, authorities are also cognizant of the fact that its economy is reeling from the 1-2 punch of the protests and now the pandemic. And the article does make reference to this. So Hong Kong has suffered its worst quarter on record. The economy has contracted by 8.9% in the first quarter from a year ago. So the government is certainly keen to stimulate local spending. And the financial secretary has said that if the global epidemic situation improves, then we should come out of the recession gradually towards the end of the year. But, you know, this is early days. We can't confirm that there won't be, you know, a boomerang effect with the virus and we see a second wave of infections, particularly if travel restrictions are loosened. They're still pretty tight at the moment. And we can't say for certain that the local chain of transmission has been broken, given the possibility of, you know, asymptomatic carriers. So again, early days, we can't say for certain what's going to happen in the next few weeks. But at the moment, there is certainly an attempt to return to normal in Hong Kong.
Jennifer, as you mentioned, not everything is reopening. Karaoke establishments, party rooms, according to the article, are remaining closed to the end of May. But hearing that in the UK and in many other parts of the world, I mean, this just sounds phenomenal. It sounds like things are getting going again. The idea that you wouldn't have mass gatherings until later this month is, you know, something a lot of us can only dream of. And a lot of people on this side of the world are treating a track and trace scheme as essentially the silver bullet to defeating coronavirus apart from a vaccine. And places like Hong Kong and South Korea are looked at because they seem to have been very successful in this. Do you credit the track and trace scheme? I know there's some civil liberties questions around it as well, but do you think other countries are right to say that is what they need, that is the solution, or something else happening in Hong Kong to allow this lifting and easing of the lockdown?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Center for Health Protection has been praised for being able to do contact tracing of confirmed cases. And we are seeing that now. I mean, Hong Kong is, of course, a lot smaller than the UK. So this has been widely praised by the public. Even as recently as a few days ago, there was a man who, we spoke about this last week, but there was another case last week as well, where a man basically tested positive again after recovering from the coronavirus several months ago. And basically, the health authorities have done a pretty good job in essentially making this known to the public and tracking down all of his close contacts. So, you know, Hong Kong has been praised for doing this, but it's worth mentioning that it reacted very early on to the outbreak of the virus when it was first detected in Wuhan. And although there was some question over whether or not the government was slow to implement travel restrictions, particularly between travelers, you know, coming in from the mainland, I think Hong Kong society as a whole was very quick to react, particularly when it came to, you know, wearing face masks and practicing social distancing. So I think there is some credit there to the Hong Kong public as well.
Can I ask two questions? One is, what's the volume of people who are flying into Hong Kong or coming into the country that are actually being put in quarantine? So, you know, people who show up, they get tested, they either test positive or seem to have symptoms. You know, how many people is that on a given day? Then, because there are parts of the United States that are also opening up, you know, it's hard to get a good read on, but in places like Georgia and Texas, where some of the restrictions on eating out, on dining out, for instance, have been lifted, but there seems to be almost nobody coming to the restaurants to sit down and eat. Do you have a sense of, you know, whether or not people in Hong Kong are actually going to take advantage of the loosened restrictions in a way that has a big economic impact?
Yeah, so in response to your first question, everyone is sent to quarantine. So this was implemented a few months ago, but any inbound traveler into Hong Kong has to undergo some sort of 14-day quarantine, whether that be at a government facility or their own home. And bearing in mind, anyone who is able to enter Hong Kong, they have to be a permanent resident. So we don't have travelers coming in and out. And I think one of the reasons why Hong Kong has been able to keep the number of cases so low is because of that, and because all inbound travelers are required to undergo a test at the airport when they arrive. So, you know, in response to your second question about dining out, there was a restriction on the number of customers who could, for example, sit at a table at a eatery, so a restaurant or a cafe. And that restriction was 4 people, and that has been raised to 8 people. But, you know, restaurants still have to practice, basically put a cap on the number of customers that they have. And we see this also in gyms. But prior to this, you could see that people were getting tired of these restrictions because Hong Kong didn't enter a lockdown like we see in different countries. People were still able to walk out and about, and we are seeing people taking, you know, really going out more, and that's particularly in terms of going out to protest. So on Sunday, we saw people basically take to various shopping malls across the city to hold protests. It's not really a traditional protest, it's more of singing and chanting protest slogans. And we are seeing how the police are using coronavirus restrictions to issue fines, which is a lot more effective than arresting people en masse. You know, normally there are dozens to hundreds of people who attend protests protests at any given time, it's very difficult to arrest everyone. So we don't know when that particular restriction on the number of people who can gather at a public place in one go, so that restriction is 8 people, we don't know when that's going to be lifted, but we are seeing people definitely taking advantage of a loosening of restrictions.
Do you think Hong Kongers want to travel? I mean, do you see appetite to leave the country and perhaps go on holiday, or are they happy that restrictions are lifting locally, and are they concerned perhaps to leave?
I mean, this is very difficult to gauge. I don't think there's been any study on Hong Kongers' appetite for traveling right now, but I would assume that, you know, summer's approaching, people want to leave Hong Kong. Hong Kong is very dense, very humid, you know, and it can be a bit like a pressure cooker. So I can imagine that people do want to go travel, and we are seeing some travel groups organizing tours in Hong Kong for when travel restrictions are lifted and travelers are able to come in. You know, there's no timetable at the moment for when those travel restrictions are going to be lifted, and Hong Kongers certainly, I'm sure they certainly want to travel. And there has been talk of some kind of travel bubble or quarantine-free corridors between countries to basically enable travelers to travel between places that are faring a lot better in terms of the coronavirus situation. So that includes Australia and New Zealand. They've been planning such a strategy and suggested that Hong Kong and Macau do the same. But this is all very hypothetical at the moment. We don't know if it's going to happen in the immediate future.
Well, to move from a country whose residents seem desperate to get back to some kind of normality to a country whose residents are much more cautious. On Sunday night, here in the UK, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson laid out what he called a roadmap to easing the lockdown. It's based on a COVID alert system, which has 5 categories, 5 being the worst. It means that the healthcare system is in danger of being overrun because the virus is spreading, 1 being the best, in which the virus is under control. And he said that the UK was in a category 4 right now, moving towards a category 3, and so some restrictions could be lifted. But while many people thought just weeks ago that the government would take a rather bullish approach to the virus and to lockdown easing, that doesn't appear to be the case. And no doubt part of that will be Boris Johnson's own contraction of the virus and the hospitalization that followed after that. The changes that we've seen primarily relate to outdoor activity. You can now exercise outside for an unlimited amount of time. An important one is that you can meet up with a friend or a family member outdoors as long as you're social distancing. So you could theoretically meet somebody in a park or go for a picnic. But the key here is that it's only one person at a time that you can meet, one parent, one friend, one relative. You can't see another household at the same time. There are some other changes too. Cleaners have been encouraged to go back to work. But overall, I would say that the UK is in a similar position than it was before these updates that we've received. The government has changed its slogan, and this has gotten a lot of backlash. It's gone from stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, to stay alert, control the virus, save lives. And a lot of people have complained that stay alert doesn't make a lot of sense, especially in the context of a virus that you can't see. But I think the idea here is that the government does want to encourage people who can't work from home but can work in their workplace in a socially distanced way to start heading back out to do so. Now, that was always the guidance, actually, but their original slogan worked so well, a lot of the British public interpreted it as, you know, don't take any risk at all, definitely stay home. And the government knows that they need to start easing people back into the economy. The Brits are not so keen to do so. Support for lockdown is still overwhelming here. When polled about this new guidance, which as said is not particularly different from where we were before, over 80% of people polled said that either they thought it was right or that it was too liberal, that the new guidance was easing too quickly and going too far. And compared to the rest of Europe when polled, Brits are really terrified of this virus and they're nervous about going back out there. And I do wonder if the major change will come as the economy continues to take a turn downwards. It's very sad to say, but unfortunately more people are going to lose their jobs and more businesses are going to go under the longer this relatively harsh lockdown continues.
The UK is thought to have one of the most generous schemes, certainly in Europe, maybe even in the world, when it comes to supporting businesses and staff. Any employer, regardless of their size, regardless of the company situation, can apply to have their staff salary covered by up to 80% with a cap of £2,500 per month. If you think about the average salary in the UK, that's really very generous. This is the furloughing scheme to allow employers to hibernate their employees. It's so generous that last month that was thought to have cost about £8 billion. And if you compare that to what we spend on the National Health Service every month, that's £11 billion. You know, it's coming quite close. This is hugely expensive and it's not sustainable. Everyone knows it's not sustainable for a long period of time. And so I think as you start to see that scheme roll back, made less generous, that may be the economic incentive that's needed to get people back into work when they actually see the changes to their salary or they start worrying more about their jobs. It's a really tough way to go about getting people back out there. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's what actually turned opinion and made people feel slightly more encouraged to go back out when all is said and done.
Yeah, can I ask, has there been any attempt to enforce this stay-at-home requirement on the part of law enforcement? And if so, what are the penalties of breaching the advice to stay at home in favour of, say, you know, going out for a picnic or an outing or something like that?
So the penalties so far have been predominantly fines. The police have been under great watch, I think, in the UK, and moments of overreaching have faced a lot of public backlash. There have been a few cases of the police really coming down hard on people who often couldn't articulate well why they might be out or actually had a good reason to do so. And there's been a lot of coverage of that. To be honest, a lot of people have been on the police side in all this and thinking that they're right to go into parks and tell people to go home. But I would say that on a more positive note, it has been a testament to the British public that they have been critical of the police where they've overstepped, and a testament to the British police that you don't have the same stories coming out of the UK as you do other parts of the world in terms of real brutality or power trips. But I think that's the nature of the British police force. I mean, famously, they don't carry guns. They have a healthier relationship, I'd say, with the public than a lot of other countries do.
Could I ask, how much of what's going on in Britain is politics by another name, or using the coronavirus to continue partisan battles? Obviously, Boris Johnson is a divisive figure. Brexit is still, you know, in the air everywhere as much as coronavirus. In the United States, you know, we're in a presidential election year, which is, you know, very strange given that you can't really campaign. But it's clear that, you know, Democrats are reading this, you know, pandemic one way and Republicans another. And it almost doesn't matter what's happening on the ground. So I'm just curious, how are partisan politics playing in British public opinion or in policymaking?
It is becoming more political by the day, but you have to consider where the UK is in its election cycle. We just had a general election back in December where the Conservatives won a clear majority. So they're just into their first few months of running the government. We wouldn't be expecting another vote, a potential change of party anytime in the near future. It's years away. So other politicians and other political parties are operating with that knowledge. They know that there isn't a chance to come in right now and to cause an upset. And so I don't think we're at the political heights that you might see somewhere like the United States, where you have a huge presidential election coming up. Broadly speaking, I think the first month of lockdown in the UK, there was broader political consensus, not necessarily for Boris Johnson specifically, although the fact that he did get sick meant that I think you did see more support actually overall, and a sense of camaraderie around the UK's prime minister. The political party and the person didn't matter as much. But I have been wondering, actually, almost thinking out loud, if the fact that it is becoming increasingly political right now may actually be a sign that the virus is more and more under control. Because when you are in a crisis, when you're facing a global pandemic that you don't have any details about, and you know, you're terrified, you're not sure what's happening, you don't have the luxury of playing politics or throwing political punches. You just have to do what that's efficient. You have to do what's necessary to keep people safe, and you have to come together on that and work together. And so I wonder, now that we are starting to see some political tensions, if that's actually a sign that, you know, there's capacity for it, because we're not as worried about the virus as we were before. The UK has devolved powers. It's a united kingdom. And in particular, Nicola Sturgeon, who leads the SNP, the Scottish National Party up in Scotland, she is starting to push back hard on Westminster. When Boris Johnson gave his speech on Sunday night, she came out immediately with the response that, no, we don't embrace this new slogan. We still want you to stay home, protect the NHS and save lives. Both Scotland and Northern Ireland have suggested that they would start to deviate from Westminster's agenda if they thought it was appropriate to do so. So yeah, I mean, those tensions are simmering, and they're definitely coming to the forefront. And I think it's only going to get more political, but perhaps that's because it can now that the virus is more under control.
You know, I think what you were saying about the furlough scheme in the UK is really interesting, because Italy has a similar one. And I was talking to people who aren't reopening their businesses because right now they think it's actually more convenient for them to stay home and to leave their staff home, with the government paying 80% of their salary, rather than reopening and risking customers not coming. So that really is a big issue, including here in Italy, where in certain sectors, employees haven't seen a penny 2 months into the lockdown. So the government is being really slow in paying these salaries. And that has been an issue. But on the other hand, some people are actually finding the system a lot more convenient than actually risking reopening their businesses and not making enough money to pay salaries. So it is really, really complicated. And I think it'll be increasingly complicated going forward.
Yeah, that's almost certainly happening here. I mean, free money is very popular, and it was much easier for them to go into lockdown with these big handouts than it is going to be to roll them back. And, you know, already you're seeing the unions, you're seeing businesses, you're seeing the government come to a head with these tensions, because everybody knows realistically this is not sustainable. But how you go about rolling back the furloughing scheme, getting people back into work, is very, very difficult. And as said, I mean, the British public, especially compared to the rest of Europe, is really very frightened of this virus. The messaging worked. And so now trying to get people into a new mindset, it's going to take weeks, if not months. I do fear, however, that given the fact that it's not sustainable, more economic damage is on the way. And speaking of economic damage and speaking of jobs, I'm going to move to Nick. More bleak news. Sorry about that, listeners. You have selected an article from 538 about the job crisis in America. So talk us through that.
Yeah, last Friday, the Department of Labor releases monthly reports on the employment status in the country. And the one that for April was just devastating. There was something like 20 million jobs were lost. And the United States now has an official unemployment rate of about 15%. It's 14.7%. And you have to go back to the late 40s, right after World War II, to find something analogous to that. And most economists, there have been various ways in which unemployment has changed, but during the Great Depression in the 30s, unemployment peaked around 25%, and most people believe that the actual unemployment rate in the U.S. is close to 20%, which also mirrors the portion of the economy that is basically devoted to services. So it makes sense. But, you know, the upshot is that there has been, in a two-month period, a devastating loss of jobs. All since the end of the Great Recession through 2019, there was something like 23 million jobs or 22 million jobs added to the economy. That's all been wiped out, with another 10 million jobs disappearing as well. And then on top of this, there is reason to believe that this is actually not the end of the process, that, okay, you know, we turn the lights off on the economy and everybody who's going to lose their job is out of their job. And this is partly what the story talks about, is that in the coming months, all of the ripple effects of the immediate shutdown are really going to start kind of filtering through the economy. And one of the most interesting and horrifying kind of things to be worried about is that so far, most of the people who have lost their jobs, it's been concentrated in the service economy. And because of government kind of compensation schemes, where the states are responsible for unemployment, and then the federal government passed pretty controversial legislation. It was passed unanimously, but it has given rise to a lot of conversation. The federal government is supplementing unemployment benefits about $600 a week, and many of the people who are unemployed now are actually making more money on unemployment than they were while they were working, which means that they have no incentive to come back to work anytime soon. The enhanced unemployment benefits will last for somewhere between 2 to 4 months and might be extended. But the real question is, when jobs of people who will not make as much money during the lockdown start disappearing, how does that change the economy? How does that change demand, which is already really far down? How does it change the complexion of the mood of the country? And I'll just add one other thing that was coming out of the San Francisco Bay Area. There was a study of people who had tested positive, and of the people who tested positive, about 90% could not work from home. So we're still in the grip of an unfolding economic kind of, it's like lava that is starting to spread all over the country. And we don't yet know exactly, where it's going to settle and what kind of cracks and fissures are in the economy that this is really going to just burn to the ground.
So, Nick, it's been really interesting to see the difference in attitude towards some Americans, at least, and a lot of people in Europe and elsewhere, because some states seem to be reopening their economies and their society even before it's thought that they've hit the peak of the virus. And whilst I'm sure some of that is political, a lot of it does seem to be driven more organically through what people actually want. And do you think a lot of that comes down to the fact that people are scared to lose their jobs?
Yeah, I think in the United States, the response to the pandemic has been heavily politicized, even as basically Democratic and Republican governors and states are doing the same thing, more or less in the same time frame. It is a presidential election season, and so everything matters, and nobody knows how all of this is going to affect turnout or even how we're going to actually hold the vote mechanically. I think, and you hear a lot of people saying that protesters in places like Michigan are, they're rubes who are being kind of directed by shadowy third sector groups, private interest groups or special interest groups. I don't think there's any evidence of that. There is a real disparity. And again, I don't think we know exactly the contours of all of this, but we can figure out kind of the basic shape, which is that there are a lot of people who have lost their jobs who are generally in less secure, lower paying places. And even if some of them are being buffered in the moment by unemployment and the federal enhancement of unemployment, they are terrified about what happens when the pandemic is over, because it could just be that a lot of these jobs don't come back. Many service jobs are always subject, like manufacturing jobs, are actually subject to automation or changes in delivery service. And so for the same reason that taxi cab drivers in big cities, fought tooth and nail to keep Uber and Lyft out, I think you're seeing people in service sector jobs now freaking out about what is the landscape going to look like in 6 months. And at the same time, the people who write and kind of define publicly what is going on, what the pandemic means in grand terms and in sociological terms, are almost completely either in government positions where their workflow has not really changed, where they work from has changed a little bit, or legacy media people who are, including myself. I mean, I'm not in the legacy media, but like my income is not really on the line for the foreseeable future, and I can write about this stuff from the safety of working from home, et cetera. And I think that divide between what might be real and the anxieties people have versus a more cautious stay-at-home mentality by people whose livelihoods and standards of living are not immediately compromised, that is going to come into full view during the summer months. And I think there's going to be a lot of conflict.
How do you think this pandemic is ultimately going to impact the election in November?
I think it's ultimately going to suppress voter turnout in a lot of ways. And I think what is happening so far is that Donald Trump has been front and center on a daily basis because of the briefings that he was holding, and those kind of get interrupted and whatnot. But he has been just so dominating the news cycle that his popularity is not going up, but it also has stopped going down. Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, who is even older than Trump and has kind of not really appeared because you can't go out in public, and then he's made a bunch of kind of online addresses and rallies, all of which the headlines inevitably lead with the technical glitches. He is old. He is not techno savvy. He's not a presence for the digital era of politics. All he can run on is Donald Trump's incompetence, which, is a legitimate issue, but he also really is not offering any kind of fresh, bold, different direction, partly because of his age and partly because the difference between him and Trump ultimately is not, you know, it's one of degree, not of kind. There is a third-party candidate, the Libertarian congressman, Justin Amash, who had been a Republican. He left the party last July because he said he was sick of the partisan death spiral. In December, he was the only non-Democrat in the House to vote for the impeachment of Trump. He's now running for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination, which will be decided in a few weeks. And he is 40 years old. His parents are immigrants. His father was a refugee from the Middle East. He presents a different ideological package, a different generational package, a different demographic package. And he's already polling at 5% a week or so after announcing. It remains to be seen if he will siphon 5% of the vote. It could. This is the type of thing where I could see him, you know, jacking up to 10 or 15% because people are kind of like one thing that is being thrown in people's faces right now is that, you know, Trump and Biden and these kind of parties are, they're floating apparitions that are constantly in your face, but they're not really affecting your life in meaningful ways.
I noticed in the article it mentioned that workers of colors are disproportionately affected by the virus in terms of becoming unemployed, and kind of more surprisingly, women. I was wondering if you could develop on that and perhaps offer some insight as to why you think that is.
I think for ethnic minorities, racial and ethnic minorities, there's a couple of things to consider. One is that they're more likely to live in urban areas, and they're more likely to be concentrated in service sector jobs. And so those are places where the lockdown has more immediate effect because there's more service sector workers and there's more low-wage jobs like that. So there's that. With women, I think it's a concentration in service sector positions. So that kind of explains why they have been disproportionately hit. The question is, what are the impacts of that? And I think what we have seen so far in terms of public, you know, demonstrations against lockdown and the shuttering of the economy, the face of that has been white, not necessarily male, but probably predominantly male. And it's seen as kind of a second wave of Tea Party activism, as opposed to, say, Occupy activism from the financial crisis. The real question is, how will this play out politically over the next few months? Because if the situation among racial and ethnic minorities in terms of lost income and in terms of like just not working or being able to go out and do things, exactly how they're going to express dissatisfaction, it's not clear. They're probably not going to be going to state capitals with guns and talking about, you know, their constitutional rights, but they are going to be felt and heard. I live in New York City. And one of the things that is very strange here is that in terms of civic life, I mean, you know, the streets are more or less deserted. The shops are more or less deserted. The ones that can be open, you don't even really need to wait online to get into most grocery stores anymore. But the people generally are missing. And I think, you know, things like crime rates, you know, are way down. Things like you haven't seen people defying orders to, you know, meet in groups and things like that. It's going to change as the weather gets better and more people start strolling. So I think we know why certain sectors are more impacted, but I don't think we know how that's going to play out for another couple of months.
And Sylvia, last but certainly not least, your story I find fascinating from the Financial Times because it's highlighting something that I think it's becoming a more and more interesting question. Is COVID-19 a national issue or a regional issue? So can you talk us through what's happening in Italy?
Yes. So the article I chose this week, written by my colleagues Miles Johnson and Daniel Dombey, offers a good explanation of how this pandemic hasn't only created geographical divides in terms of casualties, but also really exacerbated existent economic differences. And for example, in the south of both Italy and actually Spain as well, although these regions have experienced less COVID-19 deaths compared to the wealthier northern parts of these countries, the economic damage of the crisis is likely to leave much deeper scars. And this is because these regions essentially lagged behind the more industrialized northern ones for years. And in Italy, we're talking about Sicily and Sardinia, the region that contains Naples and the Amalfi Coast. And in Spain, we're talking about Andalusia. So obviously, these regions rely heavily on tourism. And because the Italian government has been very slow in delivering support for small businesses, and many of these businesses down south, including the ones that operate in the tourism industry, haven't seen a penny yet from the government, and they're all facing costs to implement safety protocols. Obviously, the question is, for how much longer will they be able to survive in these circumstances? And the big debate in Italy right now is whether certain parts of the country where infection rates are low should be allowed to reopen. The article mentions a spat between the regional government of Calabria, one of Italy's poorest regions, and the national government, because the Calabria government broke off from the national guidelines by allowing outdoor table service to resume. But then it was stopped by a court order, which was triggered by an appeal from the national government. But obviously, this is very much a big question. If the government isn't going to give these businesses free money or loans or subsidies, how are they expected to survive while they wait for infection rates to go to zero up north? So on Monday, the Italian government finally decided it was going to look at options for reopening businesses in places with infection rates close to zero. And this could happen as soon as this week. But at the same time, as the summer approaches, we're all wondering really what is going to happen for places that live on tourism. You know, we were mentioning people's appetite to travel earlier and their willingness to go out and about to restaurants or cafes. And indeed, this is the main question because, you know, will tourists, including international ones, come? Will international tourists actually be allowed to come into Italy without having to self-isolate for 2 weeks? Will the average Italian family be able to afford holidays? Will beaches even be open? And will people feel safe to go to beaches? And, you know, right now it feels like the answer to most of these questions is a big fat no. So will the government be giving these industries subsidies or grants? And right now, all we've seen is the offer for certain sectors to ask loans, actually within 25,000 euro. So it's not, you know, it's not massive amounts of money for businesses that have no revenue since March. And as the situation deteriorates, the question will become increasingly pressing, especially for politicians. And because Italy is part of the European Union and because Italy has a very high public debt, the question will be, where does the Italian government get the money to actually subsidize and help businesses survive? So it's very, very concerning. And the north and south divide is very interesting. And also, you know, it shines a light on one of the sectors that will be one of the main ones, especially going forward into the summer, and that is expected to take one of the biggest hits.
Can I ask, what is the nature of the antagonism between the north and the south? You know, I mean, I know that it's, you know, it's rich versus poor, it's industrial versus more agricultural and things like that. But how is that likely to manifest itself within Italy? Is it protests? Is it, you know, is it attempts to break away? Or, you know, how do you think that will show up?
Many people down south believe that if the COVID outbreak had been a lot more severe down south than up north, the government wouldn't have forced the northern regions to wait on infections to decrease in the south before restarting the economy. So essentially, the south has always had this feeling of being left behind, but actually southern regions are perceived as the slackers up north. And northern regions have actually complained because even if infections up there are still high, they want to reopen their business
businesses and they don't want to, you know, be forced to shut down, or they don't want to lose clients to foreign competition because of the situation. But they've also often made remarks that indicate, you know, they don't want to be working and they don't want to pay tax to subsidize southern regions and businesses down south that have lived off the state, according to people up north, and that have never worked as hard as they have. This divide is really, really old in Italy, and the South lacks the infrastructure, and it has organized crime that has really permeated to different levels of the economy. Corruption is a lot higher, but also the economy and the regions are a lot more rural. So it's essentially two very different areas of the country, where the South resembles the North of Africa and the North resembles rich European regions. And this right now, I don't think will have much of an impact in the short term, but politically, it's a very, very strong and powerful debate. And depending on how the government moves, I think voting and voters will shift both in the South and in the North when the next election comes around.
You know, one of the things, just to follow up quickly in that article, which I think I'm sure all of us would, you know, say this was happening in our respective countries, is that there's a bunch of people who have been pushing a political agenda. And in Italy's case, it's, you know, infrastructure into the South. If we can build more railroads or more roads, more people would go there or more business. But in the United States, it's certainly the case where both, you know, everybody all over the political spectrum, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, you know, presents a perfect opportunity for my solutions, you know, which are tailored to this particular moment in history, but I've been espousing, or my party has been espousing, for the past 50 years. And I think that's part of the fatigue that's setting in, where we realize, you know, politics is just not a good way to deal with things that are changing right in front of us, because they're always kind of selling yesterday's solutions to everything.
You know, Sylvia, you mentioned previously that there was a kind of subsidy scheme, if you will, for people who were rendered unemployed from the pandemic. And just to draw a parallel, in Hong Kong, you know, the Hong Kong government has attempted to address what is essentially a looming employment crisis through multiple rounds of stimulus spending. So namely a $8 billion Hong Kong dollar wage subsidy program, but that's not expected to be distributed until June. So there's not a lot of public trust in terms of how quickly the government can help out ordinary residents and businesses. So I just wanted to ask, in terms of public trust in the government, is there much in terms of trust in the government to pull the country and small businesses out of this, you know, financial slump?
So the prime minister has still a consensus throughout the Italian public that is still pretty high, because he's seen as a very reassuring figure. But people across the board are becoming very tired of all these mixed signals and confusing messages the public is receiving from the government. You know, we've seen lots of press conferences where the announcements haven't been very clear cut and have stirred lots of reactions from other political parties. So I think ultimately the government will end up coming out of this crisis severely weakened, because the response, especially the economic response rather than the response to the health emergency, so far is perceived as largely insufficient.
Nick, your point is well taken, that for a lot of people, coronavirus has magically proved that what they've always been advocating for in terms of politics and public policy is necessary now more than ever. Over in the UK, we have MPs who are trying to form a coalition to advocate that we should deprioritize the importance of economic growth. And you do just have to wonder, whether you agree with that or not, if now, as people are losing their jobs and businesses are shutting down and we see the importance of the economy, if now is really the time to be advocating for such policies, if they'll get a lot of traction on that. But then, of course, the stories that Sylvia and Jennifer have highlighted today go to show that a lot of these tensions were always there. Tensions between North and South, tensions between protesters and their government, very legitimate causes that are only going to be made more obvious, I think, as we go through this COVID-19 response and process. So much to talk about, so much more, which I'm sure we'll cover on next week's episode of Coronomics. Nick, Sylvia, and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me. Listeners, you can catch up on all of the Coronomics podcasts by subscribing to Spectator Radio and listening to the series there. And if you're listening in America, you can subscribe to Spectator USA with the discount code Kate.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.